both talk to him. But I really do think that there's a fight right now in Rio for the narrative of what the Olympics are doing, because I sat down with Paez and I raised things like 77,000 people have been displaced. And he looked right at me and said, it's just not true. Nobody's been displaced. I raised with him the idea of this bike path that was destroyed by a wave sending, killing three people. And he said, no, that wasn't an Olympic project. So we have a fight for the narrative at play.
So we're going to continue this conversation and post it at democracynow.org. Special thanks to Dave Zirin, author of Brazil's Dance with the Devil, the World Cup, the Olympics, and the Fight for Democracy, and Jules Boykoff, his new book, Power Games, A Political History of the Olympics. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks so much for joining us.
This is KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Afrocentric Pregnancy and Baby Care Fair, Sunday, June 5th, 2 to 5 p.m. at Montevilla Park in Portland. Attendees can participate in activities such as lead testing, face painting, dancing, and massages. Meet and connect with doulas and midwives and attend workshops about parenting and more. Again, that's the Afrocentric Pregnancy and Baby Care Fair, Sunday, June 5th, 2 to 5 p.m. at Montevilla Park, 8219 Northeast Gleason Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
God is sure gonna bless the child.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Improvisation Summit of Portland, hosted by the Creative Music Guild Thursday through Saturday, June 3rd, 4th, and 5th at Disjecta in Portland. The Improvisation Summit of Portland features creative, improvised, and experimental music such as Golden Retriever and the Portland Jazz Composers Ensemble in collaboration with dancers, film, and other artists. This all-ages event runs from 8 p.m. to midnight on Thursday and Friday, and Saturday will run from noon to midnight. Again, that's the Improvisation Summit of Portland, hosted by the Creative Music Guild, Thursday through Saturday, June 3rd, 4th, and 5th at Disjecta, 8371 North Interstate Avenue in Portland. More information is available at kboo.fm on the right-hand side of the homepage under Community Events.
Good evening. Coming up next, we have KBOO Community Evening News. This program has been brought to you in part by KBOO's or Portland's Gay Directory, providing a resource guide of openly gay-friendly businesses, organizations, and services since 1996. New smartphone app available for all iPhones and Droids. For more information, you can visit gaypdx.com.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on KBOO Evening News, Portland Public School will be testing students for lead.
Live in Studio 2, we speak with developer Rob Justice about his latest affordable housing project.
And Dan Forbes also joins us to talk live about his reporting on Portland's toxic air.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, June 1st, 2016. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Grace Ann Smith. Workers employed at the Burgerville on Southeast 92nd and Powell have announced that they are joining the Burgerville Workers Union. This is the fifth Burgerville location to join the BVWU, which was formed earlier this year. The BVWU is associated with the Portland branch of Industrial Workers of the World. The union has demanded a $5 per hour wage hike for all hourly workers. They are also looking for an improvement in benefits and workplace conditions. Burgerville CEO Jeff Harvey denounced the union in a letter to employees on May 6th. To date, Harvey has refused to meet with the union. Burgerville was founded in 1961 and has 41 locations in Oregon and Washington with over 1,500 employees.
Oregon's new motor voter law added 54,000 new voters to the rolls in the first 4 months of 2016. This is double the number of new voters that are normally registered in a full year. Under the new law, individuals 18 years old and older are automatically registered to vote when obtaining a driver's license or state-issued ID cards. Under the old motor voter law, new drivers had to take a separate step to register to vote. Under the new law, motor voter registrants do not choose a party affiliation at the time of their registration. Voters choose a party in a follow-up mailing that they receive several days later. Of the 54,000 new voters, only 13,000 later registered with any party. Party affiliation is a requirement to vote in primaries in Oregon, but all new registrants will be eligible to vote in the general elections.
The Morrison Bridge will glow orange on Thursday, June 2nd, in observance of National Gun Violence Awareness Day. Portland is joining cities across the country by lighting public buildings and structures in orange. Mayor Charlie Hales and other Oregon mayors will also be wearing orange to show their support. The movement arose after 15-year-old Hydea Pendleton was shot to death in Chicago in 2013. Friends started Project Orange to commemorate her life and bring attention to the public health crisis resulting from gun violence. This is the second year of the Wear Orange movement. In addition to the lighting of the Morrison Bridge, there will be a public program at the First Unitarian Church at 1022 Southwest 12th Avenue from 7 to 9 p.m. tomorrow night. The program will feature survivor stories, poetry, and music, and will be followed by a walk to the Morrison Bridge.
There's only about a week of classes left for Portland Public Schools, and no students are looking forward to the end of the school year as much as Superintendent Carol Smith and the rest of the Portland School Board. The Oregonian last week broke a story about elevated lead levels in the water supply at two Portland schools. Willamette Week followed up with a document from the school district that showed from 2001 through 2012, some 47 schools were tested for lead and many had elevated levels, but no one at the district office could say who did the testing and what was done with that information. The district held a brief public meeting last night. At that meeting, Portland Public Schools board member Steve Buell asked tough questions that impressed moms and dads in the room. Today, KBOO's Lisa Loving spoke with Buell about the situation. You can tune in tomorrow night for her full interview.
What is the situation as you see it as a member of the school board? What's going on with the lead in the water of the schools?
Well, they tested two schools and found lead in the water. Eventually, in one school, they turned off the water right away. One, they let it go for about 8 days. Then they turned it off. Now we're looking at, well, if there's lead in two schools, we checked a third school. There was no lead, but we may have lead in tens of schools. And evidently, we haven't done a very good job of checking to see for several years.
So there was an important public meeting last night. What happened? What did you hear from people?
Well, the first part of the meeting was a school board meeting, actually, where we talked a little bit about what steps we should take moving forward. And one of the things that the school board decided to do was to have a totally independent review of what took place. And it was followed by a community meeting, and the community meeting was pretty well attended. It was 6 o'clock's a hard time for some people, but there were a lot of people who were angry, a lot of people who had questions about how did this come about, how did this happen. And there are people who were angry at the superintendent and brought up old problems that people have been angry for some time about. So I thought it was pretty well handled. We did a pretty good job of answering the questions that we knew the answers to. There's a lot of questions that we just don't know the answers to yet.
As a member of the school board, who is obviously and publicly dedicated to getting to the bottom of this situation with the water in the schools, what do you think is the most important thing for all of us in our region to know about this situation and what might be done about it?
Right now, I think the most important thing is to understand that it could have been your child at your school. And some people have the means and ability to get their child tested for lead. And you should do that right away. To find out what the situation is. And that's what people in the community who have children in the school should be doing, basically. Last night I tried to say, let's speed up the process for the drinking fountains where children have been drinking the water. Let's get them tested right away and get that information out to people so they would know, no, they're fine at my kid's school, because like at Lewis School, evidently they were fine. And fine in terms of being under the standard. I haven't actually looked at Lewis School to see if they were, you know, any lead is bad for children.
All right. Steve Buell, school board member, Portland Public Schools, thanks for coming in today.
Thank you. It's always nice to come down to KBOO. They do such great work.
For KBOO News, I'm Lisa Loving.
Portland public school parents have one more thing to worry about for their children: lead in the water at school fountains. With our weekly poetic justice commentary, here's KBOO News poet Dan Raphael, whose glass is over full.
Don't drink the water, don't breathe the air, don't play in the schoolyard. It's a thirsty day at school and you need a drink, but before you start slurping, you should stop and think. In 2012, 47 school buildings had excessive lead. How they repair them, no one has said. This spring, they found high lead at Rose City Park in Creston. Why did it take 8 days to turn the fountains off and fix them? In a city where school parents have a wide range of gripes, let's talk class size and teacher pay, not the condition of the pipes. Maybe if water fountains had to take standardized tests, that'd be one less obstacle for making our schools the best. This is Poetic Justice. We all need a little education.
As Portland and the rest of the nation reels under a lack of affordable housing, a few individuals have stepped forward with solutions. One of those people is Robert Justice, founder of the nonprofit organization JOIN, which has for many years offered services to houseless people in the area. But today we are going to talk about Rob's organization that builds affordable housing, Home First Development. Rob, we've heard tales of responsible developers for a lot of local residents. Those two words do not go together. The phrase that came up in the newsroom this afternoon was activist developer. Can you start out by describing what your business model?
I can, and I actually appreciate that sentiment. I actually see myself more of an activist than a developer. For years, I worked with folks on the streets with the goal of helping them end their poverty, find a place to live, an income. And in that effort, for years, we saw the availability of housing go away. And what I also saw is, you know, the city and PDC and the Housing Bureau commit lots of money, tens of millions of dollars, but units weren't getting built. So I kind of put on my country hat. I grew up in a rural area, and when I was a kid, we built our own house, so started to look at that issue. And one of my board members at JOIN, Dave Carboneau, you know, started looking at the issue, and he said, you know what, this affordable housing is really a math issue.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, we started kind of playing with the numbers a little bit and said, if we wanted a $500, $600 rent, let's work backwards. And in that, we eventually came up with what, you know, we call a formula.
Okay. How are you doing this cheaper than the city?
Well, you know, part of it is that we don't, use city money. And honestly, not adding that extra layer of bureaucracy is huge. But part of the model really is tapping into small businesses. So a lot of the general contractors, the subcontractors we're using are, you know, smaller contractors. We don't contract with big, you know, architectural firms downtown. So from design to the building to the property management, we're using smaller businesses.
Mm-hmm.
And in that, we're able to do it at a more affordable price. The other part of what we do, which is, I think, critical, is the folks that we're working with believe in the mission of what we're doing. So in that, nobody who works for us is getting paid on a percentage. So developer fees, architectural fees, it's not based on the percentage of a project. So it's based on reasonableness. And using this cost structure, you know, that formula I talked about, to be able to hit our price point. What we find is there's lots of folks who are in the industry that want to work with us. And in that, we're also finding lots of nonprofits, churches that want us to build affordable housing for them.
Great. And what is your financial system in making this happen?
Well, it's a good question because people look at us. Part of it is our ability to build affordably. So that's part of the variable. The other is tapping into organizations or churches that actually already have land.
Mm-hmm.
So a church, and we're building a housing project for a church in North Portland, you know, they own the land. So the equity that you need for this project, most of it's there. And then so when we realized, when we were kind of using the formula and looking at what we wanted to build out that property, it came down to we needed an additional $300,000 to build 26 units of housing. Now, think about it. You know, of the amount of money that the city spends, you know, the cost per unit, we're talking, you know, tens of millions of dollars. And here we're able in North Portland with $300,000, and we're actually able, the church was able to come up with that, we're going to be able to build 26 units of affordable housing. And at the same time, you know, the church is thrilled because all of a sudden it's in line with their mission. You know, the community is re-energized. So that model, and what is interesting is this formula that we're using is really a private sector approach. So it's a lot of for-profit developers use that, but the big difference for us is there's not a big profit margin. So everybody agrees, and we look around the room, people are not going to make as much profit as is made with the city-funded projects.
Oh. What is the motivating factor in getting more responsible property developers out there?
You know what? I think that's a tough one. I feel very strongly that part of our affordable housing crisis lands on the shoulders of the Portland Housing Bureau and PDC. Over the last 10 years, those two governmental agencies have spent over $1 billion on affordable housing. What did we get for that affordable housing? So, and developers that are interested in building affordable housing, but when they engage the city, the cost to do business is high. And the expectations with the city of who you use, the type of general contractors, the architects, they're all high-end, you know, businesses. So, you know, I welcome other developers who, you know, want to look at our model. I encourage anybody to look at alternatives. You know, to me, tiny houses, you know, somebody willing to, you know, convert a garage to a studio, whatever it is, we need to be doing all of it because the city of Portland is not getting it done.
And who's working with you on this?
Well, what's been fun for us is we have several nonprofits and churches that have stepped up. I mean, my partner in crime at Home First Development is Dave Carboneau. You know, he's a retired executive from PGE. He's kind of a math wizard. And he's the guy who, you know, really works with different groups to figure out the financing and what that looks like. One of the best partners that's happened to us early on is a nonprofit in East Portland called PHC Northwest. A lot of people might not be familiar with them, but PHC employs people with disabilities. So if you're at the airport, the janitorial folks are PHC. So PHC already owned some housing. They already have property management, maintenance, landscaping. And again, their mission is to employ people with disabilities. So that partnership with kind of our, you know, basic model in our formula, along with that, you know, decades of working, managing housing and doing the maintenance, was a perfect marriage. So we really have honed the model to build very quality in units at a very affordable price.
Who are the other responsible developers in our region?
That's a good question. You know what's interesting in that? I mean, a lot of people will bring up Eli Spedak. I mean, you know, I think he's doing a lot of good work. What I find is there's a lot of people who like the idea, you know, of being more responsible, but, you know, kind of the economics of development. And, you know, when you get in a business where you're dealing with, you know, millions, tens of millions of dollars, I think people very quickly rationalize, well, you know, I can make, you know, a little more money. It's worth, and that I would describe it, that greed factor is a huge variable. And frankly, you know, for us, we've had other folks approach us and said, you know, would you build housing for us? And we kind of walked the road with them a little bit to really see, are they committed to that affordability? And are they committed to that affordability long term?
Mm-hmm. Rob, was there an aha moment when you thought about creating Home First Development? Was it that brought you from Home First?
Well, when I was at Join, when I'm working with homeless folks, it was becoming harder and harder to find affordable places for people to live. And you know, and so for me, it was like, well, you know, there has to be a different way. That was actually 10 years ago. So 10 years, you know, today, this year, we'll build 241 units. Next year, we're building 258 units, and we're doing that without government.
Wow. Rob, what is the most important thing about how development works that our listeners should know?
Well, I think what's important for people to realize is, you know, affordable housing and housing development is big business and it's big money. And if we are going to really start to address the affordable housing issue, we have to somehow not only acknowledge that, but to recognize that it's immoral. It's not okay for people to make millions of dollars on the backs of poor people.
Mm-hmm. As a citizen in a country where so many people are living on the street, Rob, what should we all be doing to resolve the housing crisis?
Well, I think there's a lot of different things you can do. One, if you have a spare room, our family have had folks live with us. You know, so to be open to that and living in community with folks, you know, building a little apartment, you know, ADU in your backyard. But I think one of the things coming up is there's going to be a big vote about a bond for an affordable housing fund. The idea that we need more money for affordable housing, absolutely. My concern is, are we going to give it to PDC? Are we going to give it to the Portland Housing Bureau, who's already puts away billions of dollars, you know, and are unwilling to change their model, which is building very expensive housing, again, on the backs of a lot of poor people.
Thanks, Robert. That was Robert Justice. He's the founder of Home First Development. Find out more about their work at www.homefirstdev.com. That's www.homefirstdev.com.
Thank you.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned from News from the BOO at 5:45, followed by stories produced by students at Rosemary Anderson High School at 6. At 7, it's the Hard Knock Radio, news views from hip-hop perspective. Get ready for some relief from the heat because tomorrow's weather is dipping back down into the 70s with showers in the morning. East of the Cascades, Hood River is also going to have some morning showers with highs in the low 70s and lows in the upper 50s. Today in history, Anne Boleyn was crowned Queen Consort of England in the year 1533. Known for her charm and wit and outgoing nature, she became the second wife of King Henry VIII. Executed 3 years later under false pretenses of witchcraft and incest, she was in fact beheaded for a failure to produce a male heir. Her daughter went on to become one of the greatest rulers of the United Kingdom. During her reign, England became a sea power and enjoyed a sense of security and a national sense of identity. Today's quote comes from Queen Anne herself, who said, quote, "And if anybody will meddle of my cause, I require them to judge the best."
State University is now offering an on-campus dorm specially designed for students recovering from drug and alcohol abuse. The university said that it believes this is the first of its kind in the state of Oregon at either a public or private institution. OSU is converting the Dixon Lodge, a former student co-op living center, into the new dorm, which it is calling the Recovery and Learning Community. OSU already has a collegiate recovery community where students can talk and socialize in a sober environment. University spokesperson Steve Clark said that separate living quarters are a necessary next step. In some cases, these dorms will be less expensive than regular housing. Students will begin moving in this fall, and there is still room available. Oregon environmental officials last week moved to continue their cease and desist order against Bullseye Glass in southeast Portland. The art glass manufacturer has been in the public eye since the Portland Mercury reported the story last February about pollution spikes in the area near their plant. Dan Forbes, who broke that story, is here live with us to talk about it. Thank you for coming in.
Well, thanks so much for having me, and apologize for a scratchy voice with a cold, but we'll proceed.
It's all right. It lends gravitas.
There you are.
Can you give us an overview of what's happened since you first broke the story?
Well, it's really been death by a thousand cuts. Until DEQ / Governor Brown felt embarrassed enough to grow a spine and issue a cease and desist on the unfiltered melting of heavy metals, real poisons such as cadmium and chromium. Prior to that, for a couple of months, there was a series of revelations in the press. And DEQ just kind of shrugged and was back on its heels playing defense. There were stories came out regarding the unfiltered use of fluorine. There were stories that came out that even prior to that, that there were no pollution controls whatsoever. And that this has been going on for 40 years and more. And it went on, and finally, I had a story on May 9th regarding a very significant test for the emissions of hexavalent chromium, which is one of the four or five nastiest poisons on the planet, a rampant carcinogen. And DEQ, prior to this emissions test, gave Bullseye Glass down in Southeast Portland a strict mandate that they had to produce glass that had about as much chromium, total chromium, of any glass that they produced. And Bullseye, as I was able to reveal, pulled the wool over their eyes and produced a glass for this test that had perhaps 1/8 or 1/10 of the amount of chromium of their most chrome-rich glass. And I think that finally just, if I may descend to the vernacular, got DEQ pissed off enough that they asked Governor Brown for authority to issue the C&D.
So is that why Bullseye received the cease and desist while Ouroboros up in Northeast Portland did not?
Ouroboros has shown a remarkable talent for sailing under the radar. And part of that reason is that they are much smaller than Bullseye, maybe approximately 1/8 or 1/10 again of Bullseye's business. But they have not engaged in the process. They don't talk to the press, not that Bullseye talks to me, but they don't have tours by TV stations. To give another example, DEQ had a committee to address the fiscal impacts of pollution controls, and four of the five Portland area glassmakers decided to serve on that committee to get their voices heard, and Ouroboros is just like, no way, no how. So they're pulling the covers over their head, and it seems to be working pretty well for them. It's also a matter that they're not in the midst of a residential community. They're right over there by I-5. And the pressure from a group such as EPAC, Eastside Portland Air Coalition, which is brought to bear primarily on Bullseye, that doesn't apply to Ouroboros.
Have any of these developments surprised you, or is it more or less what you expected to happen?
I would say that I was surprised by DEQ's lack of investigatory verve, that the regulatory agencies, you can call them regulation, you can call it supplication, depend on self-reporting by industries. And these are folks who have spent a career in air toxics regulation. But for instance, a month or two into this, they expressed the fact that they had no knowledge that the benign form of chromium, when heated at the temperatures of a glass furnace, would turn into the rampant carcinogen. That seemed just beyond them to know that. And they also, had another issue. Oh, here's one. They depended on monthly averages to see what heavy metals were a problem. And for instance, lead had a low monthly average back when they did their initial readings in October, but that totally overlooks the fact of how glass is made, that it's made in a one-day melt, and they might be only 1 or 2 days per month. And so even though the fact that the state fire marshal had data that Bullseye Glass had between 12,000 pounds and 62,000 pounds, there's a wide margin given the fire marshal's data, but still the minimum was 12,000 pounds of pure lead on hand at Bullseye Glass. That fact just didn't seem to register with DEQ, and until this recent crisis regarding lead admissions, they didn't seem to express any interest in lead. It's sort of, I don't know, just not doing your homework or saying there's a rock over there, we're not going to kick that over to see what's underneath it. Let's, you know, who knows what we might find.
Well, your reporting on the stories really touched a nerve with a lot of people in Southeast Portland, my family included, as both of my daughters spent years at the daycare center right next to Bullseye. What are the folks who live around that area or whose kids have gone to daycare down there, what are they telling you about or what are their reactions to the story?
Well, it's really, there's a before the cease and desist order and after. Prior to Governor Brown taking what is a politically charged action in an election year, and the governor is under a lot of pressure from folks who use Arc Glass, both Ouroboros and Bullseye, all over the country, mom and pop studios who use this stuff because it is among the best glass in the world. So it's a politically charged move by the governor. But prior to that, folks in the pollution hotspots felt a lot of frustration. They felt that they were not being dealt with in good faith by the companies. And they were sort of beating their heads against the wall, and DEQ was not standing up on its hind feet to protect them. And now that has changed.
Well, so to your point, DEQ has had this raw data for a long time. Was it simply their failure to act on it that caused the media to ignore the story for so long, or were there other factors involved?
Well, I don't know that I'd necessarily accept that premise. High levels of heavy metals surfaced around Ouroboros in 2009, and DEQ and EPA identified them and then did a very cursory and a follow-up test that just did not meet the basic necessities of how you test for air toxics. And they said, oh, well, this cursory test didn't find much. Boom, we'll let it go. We know there are dangerous levels of emissions here, but we can't find them, and we don't have any money to do so. And so they dropped the story, and so did the media. And really, that's where it lay until I was fortunate enough to encounter data on the emissions from October and October of 2015 that I was able to report in February, and since then it's been off to the races.
In addition to that initial data that you had back in October, have you put together more data since then?
Well, I'm not putting data together.
Have you been provided with data? Has there been more supporting evidence that has come out since you initially broke the story?
Well, DEQ has been issuing weekly updates for the last five or six weeks, perhaps, and they're finding continuing worrisome levels. And that's when Bullseye, in its hubris, decided that they needed to make some lead-rich glass, and in a 1,200-pound batch of molten glass, they put approximately 100 pounds of a lead compound, and which is 10 times more than they would on a typical day. And somehow, whether it's arrogance or hubris or I'm not quite sure what, they just felt that DEQ would overlook it or not find it, even though they were aware that there were air monitors surrounding Bullseye. But they went ahead with this melt, and that ultimately led to the cease and desist, because lead is something that everyone understands, it seems.
At the conclusion of this cease and desist order, what more do you think that state and local officials ought to be doing to confront this issue?
Well, let me put it this way to the listeners. Look around whatever room you happen to find yourself in and pick a very obscure oddball color in some furnishing there in the room. And then pretend that you're an architect down in San Francisco in Marin County, and you call up Bullseye and say, I have a project. I need $20,000 of glass exactly that odd color that you're looking at in your room right now. Bullseye is smart enough to make that color for you. They're about the best in the world at what they do. So for them to say, and the way they do that is to massage their recipes down to, okay, out of 1,200 pounds, we're going to add a single pound more of a particular heavy metal and maybe take a half a pound away of a different one. So if you know to that degree of expertise what's going in your furnace, it strikes me as disingenuous to say that you had no knowledge for 40 years of what was coming out of the furnace. That's a long way of saying it would seem to me that the time of unfiltered melting of heavy metals here in Portland should come to an end, and that is what I would look to from DEQ.
Well, thank you very much, Dan, for reporting on this story and for coming in today to talk about it. It's made a huge difference, I think, in Portland this year. That was you've been listening to Dan Forbes of the Portland Mercury. You can read his newest piece on air pollution at www.portlandmercury.com.
May I say, stay tuned.
The majority of salt in our diets isn't from the salt shaker, but from prepackaged foods. Today, Americans consume about 50% more sodium than is recommended. All that excess salt is coming from the large amounts of prepackaged foods Americans are consuming. The FDA is encouraging producers of prepackaged foods to voluntarily reduce sodium in their products by a third over the next 10 years. One in three Americans suffer from high blood pressure, which is the leading cause of strokes and heart attacks. If companies follow through, this could have a significant impact on public health.
The UN Food and Agriculture Organization estimates about one-third of the food produced globally goes to waste, creating a massive amount of greenhouse gas emissions and needlessly squandering water, land, labor, and energy resources. This waste is drawing the attention of global agricultural organizations and financial institutions, which have started to back initiatives aimed at scaling back food waste. But a group of farmers in Uganda have already come up with a solution, transforming food into novel products with a longer shelf life. Ngala Killian Chimtam reports.
Elizabeth Nsimadala is a 36-year-old mother of two from a small village in southern Uganda. She is a founding member of a group of female farmers who have been making big returns by turning bananas into wine, a relatively novel product now adding diversity to Uganda's cuisine. But it was not always so. Before the year 2000, Nsimadala struggled to make ends meet in agriculture, frequently going hungry and repeatedly unable to pay school fees for her kids. Then an NGO came along, teaching farmers in her area about better ways of producing and managing banana yields. And while the methods did increase output, Nsimadala says it had unintended consequences.
The project, which was supposed to be a blessing to the communities, became a problem because there was overproduction, but the prices decreased. So, you know, instead of getting money from the bananas, a bunch went as low as 500 Uganda shillings. I don't know, this is something like a quarter of a dollar. So it went so low to that level. And, you know, people were instead chopping the bananas and giving them to animals. So they became of no use.
Her story is common across Africa, where harvested food crops are often lost because the cost of transporting them to markets is more expensive than letting them rot in place. Meanwhile, people who need food the most don't have money to buy it. Nana Osei-Bonsu, CEO of Private Enterprise Federation Ghana, says this aggravates food insecurity on the continent.
$4 billion U.S. dollars equivalent of food losses in a year in the continent. And if you can conceptualize what $4 billion can do to alleviate poverty in our various countries, then you can understand the waste and the economic deprivation that food loss is causing the continent. apart from food losses, there's a food waste. The two different things. The food waste is the cooked food that we don't use. And at the end of the day, they're not apportioned to people who need it. And we have about 800 million in the world going hungry every day. And we have excesses of food that are going to waste.
The causes of food loss and food waste in Africa are closely linked to lack of infrastructure, affordable transportation, and even harvesting techniques, says Nana Osei-Bonsu.
Let me give you an example. Tomatoes. People harvest them when they're red. When they're red and you pick them, they don't even last 36 hours. But if you pick them green, they give you 7 days or more. So there are a lot of factors that contribute to this magnitude of losses.
The inefficiency of moving food stocks to hungry mouths can be an even bigger problem in 50 years, when Africa's population is expected to double. Musa Sek is the chairman of the Pan-African Agribusiness and Agro-Industry Consortium.
If the world population doubles, what should be doubled then? It's not cars, it's not highways, but it's mostly food. But the problem is, mankind has made more than 10,000 years in order to come up today to 7 billion tons worth of food. 10,000 years of constant progress. And when the world population doubles in 50 years, we have to double these 7 billion tons.
African countries, through the Comprehensive Africa Agriculture Development Program, say they are committed to eliminating hunger and cutting extreme poverty in half by 2025. How this will be achieved, according to SEC, is not only through production, but more importantly, by avoiding the loss and waste of food already produced. Elizabeth Nsimadala and other farming women in Uganda could offer significant lessons in this regard. The bananas that used to be thrown away are now fetching them significant returns on their investment, thanks to value addition. In other words, processing the crop into another more novel product with a longer shelf life.
We were trained in banana wine production. We started the production on a small scale, but like for a new innovation that comes, it takes some time for people to embrace it. But later on, our mindset kept on changing. I do a comparison between the prices. It's actually more than 100%. For example, a bunch that can go for $10, once processed, you can be able to make a net profit of $200, which is unbelievable to many, but to me it's a reality because I'm doing it, we are doing it, and we are getting the results.
Nsimadala's success has been hailed as a best practice by the African Union, but continues to be an exception to the rule. In the short term, however, Bonsu recommends that African governments set up agencies to buy and store food in peak season for eventual redistribution during lean periods. Ngala Kilian Chimtom, FSRN, Accra, Ghana.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call us with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032, extension 203. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Dan Raphael, Ray Bodwell, Grace Ann Smith, and Sam Tallner. The producer is Jenna Yokoyama. Special thanks to Free Speech Radio News. Our engineer is David Kesters. The KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can find us also on Facebook and Twitter at KBOO News. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath at 104.3 FM, and K220HR in Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Brian Pritchett.
And I'm Grace Ann Smith. Coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO, at 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8 on Voices from the Edge, host Joanne Hardesty speaks with former Oregon State Treasurer Jim Hill about the book The New N-Word, The White Middle Class. At 9, Teresa Mitchell hosts Press Watch, The News You're Not Supposed to Know. At 9:30 on Fight the Empire, Perfoggering interviews Professor Michael Brenner. about his article, America's Worst Laid Plans, and how the U.S. government seeks to impose neoliberal economics on the world. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris André. At 10:15, hear Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, on Between the Covers with Pamela Santos, speaks with writer Helen Oyeyemi about her latest collection of short stories. And at 11:30, on Black Book Talk, hosts Emma Jackson Ford, Patricia Welch, and O.B. Hill speak with scientist Margaret Ellen Mayo Tolbert about her new book, Resilience in the Face of Adversity.
And now it's time for News from the Boo, the weekly segment from people inside of and around KBOO with news from your community radio station.
I'm KBOO Evening News and Public Affairs Director Lisa Loving, and I'm talking tonight with station manager Monica Beamer. Monica, it's nice to see you.
Nice to see you, too.
We don't normally start News from the Boo by talking about events, but summer is here. There's fun and important stuff going on, and KBOO's doing it.
And sometimes it's fun and important. And a couple things I wanted to mention particularly, because we have a lot. It's remote season, remote broadcast season, where